Kapi'olani Park, its unique trust status, offers protections like no other park on Oahu. The courts require regular reports on how that trust is being managed. The latest, filed in July and updated in December, sheds new light on whether the city council is doing a good job managing the park in line with trust restrictions. The Attorney General's office thinks maybe not because of inherent difficulties in fulfilling the responsibilities of the trust. Joining us this morning is Alethea Redman with the Kapi'olani Park Preservation Society. The nonprofit acts as a watchdog and has raised critical questions. Has the park reached its caring capacity, and is the council neglecting its duties to the trust, keeping the park free and open to all? Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, the society had raised this question, if I recall right, about whether it was a good idea to have the trustees serve or have the city council members serve as trustees of the park. Wasn't that an issue way back when?
Yes, it's been an issue since they were put in place as trustees in 1991. The court put them in as trustees essentially in the absence of any other options. The former park commission had been disbanded a while ago. And so the judge put them in as trustees, but recognized that they would have conflicts of interest. So it's been a problem for a long time.
Right, because they were reluctantly tapped to serve as trustees.
Right.
So what's the snapshot now? I know the Attorney General has said that they've asked the court to maybe reconsider the makeup, that maybe it's not working as some had hoped.
Yes, that's right. In the Attorney General's response that was filed December 14th of 2017, they did suggest that to the court, that this might be the time to look at that again.
And so what have you been seeing since the last report?
Since the last triennial report? Well, things don't seem to have changed on the city side. They're essentially reluctantly complying with court orders to report. It's difficult for them. The city budget for parks is only 4% of their operating budget. It's only $7.2 million out of the, I think, approximately $8 billion in the city budget. So they struggle on implementing the recommendations in place.
And the issue of commercialism in the park, I know, has been kind of a thorn on the side of the city. That's kind of what spurred this lawsuit way back when the city tried to build the Burger King in the zoo.
Yes.
And we came up with a decision from the Hawaii Supreme Court that kind of sets some parameters for what can and can be in that park.
Yes, that 1988 decision is a big trust decision because there aren't that many public charitable trusts. So the Supreme Court issued that, and they sent it back to the circuit court to issue basically implementing orders on the trust. So there's a 1991 court order by Judge Chun that sets out what the city is and isn't to do.
And so tell us, what's your take on what's happening as far as the caring capacity and the commercialism that you're seeing? What kind of complaints are you getting?
We get a lot of complaints on commercialism, so I'll start with that. Our biggest complaint driver is the surf schools. They're back all along Kalakaua, which is in the trust, and operating out of the area from the Groin all the way to Kaimana Beach. And no surf school permits can be issued in that area by the city. So they take up parking, they take up surf breaks, things like that. We also get a ton of complaints about the fee or donation-based yoga classes in the park. There are a lot of those, including nighttime yoga. I think they call it glow yoga. There are places that actually have Kapi'olani Park as their address. Contact us at Kapi'olani Park. Find us here. Or one says, park at the zoo and meet us here. Zoo parking is meant to be for park users only by court order.
Right, and I know the recent plan to put Beaky Bike stations within the park, that met with some resistance by, I think, one of the neighborhood boards in the area, some residents, and then the society also raised some questions about whether that was appropriate.
It's a difficult issue because certainly biking is appropriate. There are currently no bike racks in the park, and we've asked for bike racks before. So the issue isn't biking to the park. The issue is having a bike rental within the park. The way Bicky is structured, it's a nonprofit, the Bicky or Bike Share, funded mainly by city grants, so funded by taxpayer money. But the underlying equipment is owned, operated, and rented out by a for-profit company. So it's essentially a bike rental within the park. So it's another concession, a lease within the park. And the city has tried to do everything they can in calling it something like a transportation easement or something like that. But as the Supreme Court said in 1988, it smells like a rose. So that is our issue with it. No matter how good the cause, and there are a lot of good causes out there, you can't put a rental operation in the park.
And there was some concern about the historic structure at the entrance to the park. A lot of folks don't know who designed it, but very famous architect.
Yes, that's the old zoo entrance designed by Alfred Price, who designed the Arizona Memorial. And it's a classic example of his style.
And what was the concern there?
Well, it was deteriorating, and the zoo and the city wanted a new entrance, a bigger entrance, and positioned more toward Waikiki. So they built that with the old building left in place. And one of our members and some other preservationists got it placed on the historic register. So it was supposed to serve as a beautiful entrance to the zoo and to be preserved. The city has, and they'll admit this, not prioritized it in their maintenance budget. They've deliberately let it fall to pieces. And recently, we found that part of the roof was removed, and we contacted the city to find out what that was about.
Right, and I know when I checked with the State Historic Preservation Office, they said, yeah, it was termite damage, and it for safety issues had to be taken care of, but I think there's still some back and forth as to what the city plans to do going forward.
There is. The State Historic Preservation Department said, basically, take some photos and go ahead and pull it down. We don't agree with that, especially when the city is letting it die deliberately by its neglect.
And the concern there is they're not managing it properly. I mean, that's the point that you're raising with that.
Exactly.
And so the city just recently put an RFP out to get sponsorships in the zoo. And that was something that I recall, I think, under Mayor Fossey, and I think at the time was Andy Anderson was the MD, and that kind of what spurred the whole issue of that lawsuit way back when. So now there's a little modification. I know they've got some rule changes. Are you folks okay with that, the way it's set up?
We're not okay with it. Going back to 2015, when Bill 25 was introduced, allowing sponsorships in the zoo, we've always spoken up about our concerns because there may be appropriate recognitions within a zoo. But allowing advertising within the zoo is against the trust rules as set forth by the court.
Okay, so still some sticky issues that you have to deal with.
Definitely. The city has its ad up for zoo sponsorships, and they make no bones about it. They say advertising, and they admit it won't be seen from outside of the zoo. And so they're treating the zoo differently than the rest of the trust land. The court has ordered that, for instance, the information kiosk outside the zoo can only be used for zoo-related and other public activities, not for commercial ventures. And they're refusing to apply that within the zoo.
All right. Okay. Well, Alethea, thank you for giving us this update on where things stand with the park. Alethea Redman is with the Kapi'olani Park Preservation Society. We did reach out to the city administration and the Honolulu City Council for comment, but didn't hear back. The AG's office says the city has asked for more time to file its response to the report, and the next hearing is set for March.
Swing to the Latin and salsa rhythms of Freddie Miranda Jr., drummer and percussionist extraordinaire, and his quintet of all-stars. Make your reservations today for their Atherton studio debut on January 27th. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org for the Freddie Miranda Jr. Quintet. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, looking at the way arts can turn your life around. But first, your quiz.
Unihau, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholave, uhawaii.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're trekking through Honolulu's Chinatown to spotlight an original building located in the Merchant Street Historic District, home to the city's earliest commercial district. In 1873, a hotel and saloon sat on the parcel in question. But by 1886, barkeeper and investor Walter C. Peacock bought the land. He saw the potential to open a series of bars for the incoming sailors. The building we see today at the corner of Nu'uanu and Merchant Streets was constructed in 1890, just 10 years before a fire in the 1900s wiped out a majority of structures in Chinatown. The red brick of the one-story building really sets off the white stucco adornments on the exterior. The architecture is a blend of Florentine, Gothic, and Renaissance revival styles with cast iron decorations. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of this colorful structure that's been home to the Royal Tavern, Royal Hotel, Jameson's Tavern, and finally, since 1987, Murphy's Bar and Grill? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Dina Yoshimi from the Hawaii Roadmap Initiative. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Art is a healing force, a source of life and energy, and a national program run by the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts is based on that idea. Turnaround Arts brings artists into struggling schools to expose kids to the ways art can revitalize education, using the example set by those artists' lives to inspire and educate. Actor Alfre Woodard is one of them. She's in Hawaii to work with students at Kalihikai Elementary School, Kamaili Academy Public Charter School, and Waianae Elementary School, and she's with us in our studio. Good morning, Alfre.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
I'm happy to be here.
Did the arts have a transformative effect in your life?
Yes, and I think they do in everybody's life. I'm of a certain generation that we actually had strong art programs mm-hmm. in the public schools, and I must say, I tell the kids when I meet them that I am not successful and out in the world advocating for them and advocating for justice and the common good mm-hmm. and all the things that I do. I'm out there because the effect that having, you know, making things with my hand, and I was terrible at it, mm-hmm. but it opened my eyes to connecting me with the museums that I went to, with people that made art, mm-hmm. with different cultures, and made me have the confidence that I could do something in the world. So I am talented, I will say, but the reason that I am successful is because not only did I have the exposure to music, to making music, and I wasn't even great at that, so it's not a matter of the quality, mm-hmm. but it expands your mind, your horizons. It creates community between students and teachers, and it completes the education. So I wanted to make sure that all American kids, and especially here in Hawaii, that they had those opportunities that we all had.
You know, pursuing arts education doesn't necessarily mean you have to make a life as an artist or become a great artist. It just means you have to open up your mind and maybe not be afraid to fail, right?
And also, it stimulates creativity, and creativity is how we solve all problems.
Yeah.
You know, we used to be a big nation of innovators back then, and we're sort of giving that up. When budgets start to slash, the first thing that goes is the arts, mm-hmm. because people think of art as a luxury or playtime,
yeah.
but it really is. It's what separates us from other animals. It starts that critical thinking. It starts the ability to it kickstarts the ability to work together. I must say, when all of us artists, we remember that, and I'm saying artists, but when people go to Congress and they testify, they've always testified about you know, what made them successful. It could be a pilot, it could be a baker or a teacher. They don't say, I wanted to fly the plane, I wanted to go into space. You know, since day one, it was that, oh, I made this, the, I made the solar system out of clay when I was in Mrs. Johnson's third grade class.
Right.
It got me thinking about the stars. And so what happened is we didn't want people to think that we were just trying to nurture artists. Mm-hmm. What we're doing is we're building citizens. So it doesn't matter what you do. It all starts with creativity and critical thinking and learning. And so we discovered through a document we put together for then-President Obama, 72-page document of all the research over 30 years, or the data over 30 years of the effect of playing instrumental music, of singing within a community, the students that had it and the students that didn't have access to it, the variation in their math scores. And when kids were, and this was all around the country over a 30-year period, and how much those scores went up. Well, now we have footage of when people are playing. There's you can see the parts of their brains that would make them susceptible to understanding mathematical concepts is vibrating and alive. And the same way with visual arts, how it stimulates language. So all of that to say, we wanted to bring that information because the people that are holding the purse strings, they want numbers and facts. They don't want to know how it makes you feel. But I'm going to tell you, it changes the culture, not only of the human being, the child, but it changes the culture of the school. And so, but we've got those facts. We got how much, you know, test scores, those horrible.
And that's what you
statements.
Need. It can't be this intangible benefit because it stayed in that intangible ghetto for a long time and without being advanced.
Intangible, but again, I mean, you go back to Plato. It is that thing that not only completes the education, it makes the education possible, the true education. Mm-hmm. But yes, it's called intangible.
You know what I'm saying?
Power,
it gets marginalized.
Yes, exactly.
In that world, but you know, and people in the arts don't need persuading, you know.
That's no.
I like that you call it turnaround arts, because I think anyone who has a life in the arts will have some version of it turned my life around.
Yes.
Right? It gave me a sense of what I can do, and that, yeah, as you said, that applies to anything.
And it turns schools around. What we are, turnaround arts, we're not an arts program for the sake of the arts. We are a school reform program, and that's what we are getting results with. We have gone into, we have about 70 schools nationwide, maybe 78, but in those schools, some of those schools have gone from F rating up to a C, C plus, B, B minus, all, and we do that within, we see that change within at least 2 to 3 years. Within a couple of months, we see a change in the culture of the school and how the kids walk in and the amount of joy and confidence. You can always tell when we come to a school and kids, you ask their name, they look around, they look down.
Mm-hmm.
But just the fact that a child, you know, kindergarten through eighth grade, will look you in the eye and say, "My name is Kalani." That's a tough thing, but that is the biggest hurdle of getting our children out into the world. When somebody looks at you and expects things of you, you buy into it and you believe you can deliver. And we see our kids in their own individual level starting to deliver all over the country.
When somebody looks at you, you've got to look back at them. It's pretty fundamental.
Yes.
But you also have to have that sense of who you are to be able to raise those eyes up and meet that gaze, don't you?
But isn't that how, I mean, that's, we're in the same generation. That's, we just want to give, in the 21st century, we want our children, they deserve it, to be able to have that sense of self. Because when you have a sense of self, then you have you've already started your respect for other human beings. And that that is the groundwork of education, is to make sure, is to civilize us, to make us civil one to each other.
When you see people mistreat each other, it's so frequently a product of their how they feel about themselves.
Oh, my. You hit it, Chris.
Don't you think?
Yeah, definitely.
But that's, you know, and that's to focus on that previously thought of as intangible benefit mm-hmm. is paying off. You're seeing the results, right?
We're seeing it, like I said, around the country. But I have to tell you that our Hawaii Turnaround Arts is becoming a star. As we go around to our different schools, we look to Hawaii and we bring up Hawaii, how the success that we're having already here. You guys have the added benefit of having a strong culture already. And so what we are doing is we are tapping into that culture as a means of a language to reach the students. And it's just amazing. We were out on Pokai Bay yesterday. We're doing a video, and you guys will see it in a couple of months, doing Love Train. And all of our beautiful kids from the three schools were there, and they were singing. And they don't even know each other, but normally you'd have kids, staying one side to another. They were all together and singing, and it is an approach that keeps people's, not only their hearts open, their minds open and receptive. When they're in the schools, the way that the students and the teachers speak to each other and the way that they interact, it's amazing to see.
It's great to hear a hopeful story of any kind. Alfred, thanks so much.
All there is hope, so we're going to keep fostering it.
We've still got it. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Alfre Woodard is an actor and mentor with Turnaround Arts, a national program run by the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts that infuses struggling schools with the arts to bolster reform efforts. Turnaround Arts has been working with three schools in Hawaii since 2015, Kalihi Kai Elementary, Kamaili Academy Public Charter School, and Waianae Elementary.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, celebrating Leonard Bernstein's 100th birthday, featuring violinist Robert McDuffie, this Saturday and Sunday at the Blaisdell. More at hisymphony.org.
Opponents of vacation rentals have been trying to regulate them for years, but the path to effective legislation may be rockier than they think, as officials on Kauai have learned. Reporter Stuart Yurton has details in today's reality check from Civil Beat. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Chris.
This looks like regulation is easier said than done. What are the obstacles they're running into on Kauai?
So what they're running into is Kauai's been more aggressive in citing people for operating vacation rentals in residential areas where they're not supposed to do it. Problem is they end up in contested case hearings before the Planning Commission, and those take years.
Mm-hmm. And so can the vacation rental basically continue to operate while it's being contested?
Yes, it continues to operate, and they can make a lot of money. And one argument is, well, they make way more money than they have to pay in attorney's fees to keep things in the contested case process. So that's what they're doing. It's in their interest to stall.
Go ahead.
Well, the other argument is that, they're just exercising their due process rights, the property owners, so it might take a long time, but that's just the way it is.
Ken, if they do get fined, what kind of fines are we talking about?
Well, the fines are right now really minimal, but what's happening is now the legislature's looking at it on the state level and is saying they've been asked to give the counties more authority to impose tougher fines and make it faster. They don't have to go through the administrative process. They could go straight to court under a bill that's in the works now.
Even going through court, you know, especially if you have a legal team that is skilled in delaying tactics, that can hold things up for quite a while, can't it?
It can hold things up, but one of the things they're asking for is to lower the requirement for getting a court order to stop it while the case goes through court. It's the preliminary injunction standard is usually pretty high. Basically, that standard would be, the bar would be lowered a whole lot to get an injunction. So under this proposal that's in the ledge right now, they could be shut down very quickly while it made its way through court.
So does that proposal, is there now a clear path toward regulating, or is it still kind of murky?
Oh, no, the proposal would be very clear if it's adopted. What's murky is whether it will get adopted by the legislature.
Well, that's always a murky subject. Thanks a lot, Stuart.
Thank you, Chris.
That was Stuart Yurton with the Today's Reality Check from Civil Beat.
We admit it, we want to get closer to you. There's so much happening at HPR these days. Great new programs, unique local coverage from our award-winning news team, and all sorts of ways we can work together to make life in our islands even better. We'd like to tell you more about HPR and would love to add you to our email list. Please sign up at hawaiipublicradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you, and with your email, you'll be hearing more from us soon.
Selling our state with sun and surf is one thing, but the groundwork is in place to showcase something else. Study Hawaii is a nonprofit that's been around for a little more than a decade. It's looking to help brands study abroad programs and give a boost to our economic health. Joel Weaver is a force behind Study Hawaii. He sat down with us earlier this week to talk about the inroads being made to entice international students and international media to our islands. Working with DBED, the Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism, the goal is to double the number of international students within 10 years. Hawaii hosts some 12,000 long- and short-term international students now, but Weaver believes it can grow to be a billion-dollar industry.
The Study Hawaii Educational Consortium grew out of a group that's called NAFSA, which is actually the Association of International Educators. And we have a local chapter of that national group. It's the largest group of its kind in the world. And it really promotes advocacy for international education, plus training for people who are bringing students in, as well as sending students out. And a number of us, back in the mid-2000s, we felt that Hawaii, while it has a wonderful reputation, wherever I travel in the world, most people know of Hawaii. Even vaguely, they have a very positive impression. But primarily, that is built on fun in the sun, and the beauty of the islands and ecotourism and golf and, you know, surfing and that sort of thing. And those of us who are in the education realm who have this passion for international students and bringing more of them here felt like we needed to corroborate that positive image of Hawaii with talking more about the educational options in Hawaii. And so we banded together and formed the Study Hawaii Educational Consortium. And we worked with DBED. DBED was actually the first government entity that expressed interest in this and saw it as a service export. In the area of exports, travel and tourism is counted as an export because people come in from overseas and spend their money here. By the same token, international students who come, and not just their tuition dollars, but all their living expenses, many times families who come will buy an apartment or a condo where they're here. So there's a lot of flow of economically.
UH and DBED worked out an agreement where they actually have a recruiter based in China, trying to get students to come to the University of Hawaii and come to school in Hawaii.
Exactly. And that's one thing that our Study Hawaii group is not trying to supplant anything that institutions are doing. We're saying each institution is still doing excellent work trying to recruit students from overseas to come to Hawaii and have a great experience at one of our programs here. But we also want to work as a state on a statewide basis, just raise everyone's perception of Hawaii as a positive study destination. For example, last fall, we launched a new campaign called Hawaii, the Best Classroom in the World, talking about the fact that because of our geographical remoteness, because of the wonderful environment we live in, both the physical environment as well as the cultural environment, that this is a perfect place for people to come, especially from Asia, to have an educational experience like no other. And there are possibilities because of our position in the middle of the Pacific, both, as I said, culturally as well as ecologically and environmentally, that students can get an experience that is world-class, unsurpassed anywhere else in the world. Areas like volcanology, marine science, marine and ocean engineering, as well as linguistic and cultural studies.
Right, and this summer you had a group of students come from Japan.
Exactly. Last summer, the Hawaii English Language Program, of which I'm the director at UH, brought in, actually they were here for 6 months of English study, internships, service learning experiences. And in the summer, we actually launched with the DBED, we launched something we're calling the Study Hawaii Ambassador Program. And so students were recognized. They've had this incredible experience in Hawaii. They're recognized by the First Lady and by the director of DBED as Study Hawaii ambassadors to go back to Japan. Those students were all from Yasuda Women's University in Hiroshima. And to go back to Japan and talk about their experience and share the good news that you can get a wonderful experience or wonderful educational experience in Hawaii.
I recall talking to one of your graduates and how she, I think, was on one path, and then because of her experience here, it really kind of broadened her interest, and she thought, well, I might go do something else.
Exactly. She had a wonderful experience in some of her service learning and her internship, and that offered her a chance to think more deeply. She had been kind of going into an education thing, which is great, but then she was thinking more tourism and hospitality, because Hiroshima is a tourist destination, but she had never thought of that as a viable career path, and this experience actually woke her up to that and made her perhaps consider coming back to University of Hawaii or another university in our state to pursue that career.
So really branding it under the ambassadorship, spread the goodwill, spread the aloha, and invite your friends and family and tell them about the good things that happen here.
Exactly. And one of the things we did actually in November last year is we brought in a bunch of media people from all over the world, from China, from Japan, from Brazil, from England, from Italy, and Slovakia. And we brought them here to have an experience, a one-week whistle-stop tour through the state and visiting a number of our Study Hawaii member institutions to find out kind of the breadth of possibilities here. And as a result of that, 2 weeks from now, we're bringing in a larger group from Taipei and Beijing, again, partnering with DBED because they have offices in each of those areas. And we're bringing in 30 media and educators for another whistle-stop tour. This time they're going to go to Maui and see Maui College and the Institute for Astronomy, the wonderful solar astronomy that's being done there, as well as Maui Preparatory Academy, which is one of our members. And then they're going to come to Oahu and visit a number of the institutions that are located on this island. So this is all part of trying to brand Hawaii as the best classroom in the world and Hawaii as a living laboratory.
We normally think of study abroad programs for college, but I know in the case of my own children, they had friends who studied abroad for their junior year in high school and vice versa.
This is a kind of transformation that's been happening in the last 5 or 8 years where many, many more juniors, that is K-12 age children, are traveling and studying abroad. So many students, and you look at Korea, you look at China, you look at Japan, which are the chief countries that send students to Hawaii, you're looking at families who are looking further ahead than just college, and they're starting to plan on sending their students or sending their children at a much earlier age. And so there's, for example, Iolani School, which is one of our members, is currently building a boarding program, and they're building a facility to host this boarding program. And so across the state, many institutions are wakening up to that. So Hawaii Preparatory Academy on the Big Island in Waimea is one of our charter members, and for years they've had a very strong international presence because, as you brought up, families are starting to send students at earlier ages. I think for Hawaii right now, the undergraduate and graduate programs are still areas where we're very strong, but the K-12, the junior programs are growing.
Right. I know MidPac has had one, HPU has had reputation, built it on being an international student body.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. And what we really want local people, because most of our support comes through the state, and what we want local people to realize is there are huge economic benefits. The gross amount brought in 2016 was $484 million, including everything. There's $38 million of tax revenue that the state brings in, but also there's the more intangible cultural richness that's brought, and the increased global understanding that our students get when these students come here from other places and exchange their ideas, exchange their backgrounds. It really builds. They experience the Aloha spirit, and then they return to their countries as ambassadors, even if we don't officially recognize them, like that ceremony we had in back in July. They go back as ambassadors of Hawaii as a sine qua non, the ultimate expression of a place that's welcoming to all different cultures, welcoming no matter what your background, what your skin color is, what your culture is. This is a place where they can get a top class, a world class education, but also build connections with Hawaii as a study destination.
And it's not just the private schools, because I know my daughter had a friend who was from France, and he attended McKinley and was just thrilled at the experience, living with a Native Hawaiian family, mm-hmm. and coming to school here and just experiencing something totally different from what you can get in France.
One of the a number of the DOE schools have tried to build these things, and not only do they bring in like groups for short periods of time, a week or 2 weeks of experience, but they also do these longer stay programs, and those are so wonderful because, as you just mentioned, they get to live in the community and really experience life in Hawaii. And that, more than anything, builds those positive, the good vibrations for people as they return home with that experience.
That was Joel Weaver of Study Hawaii talking about a new way of branding the islands as the best classroom in the world. I'm Catherine Cruz, and you're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier in the show, we asked you to name a well-recognized building in the Merchant Street Historic District. After the Hawaiian government permitted liquor sales in 1862, Lower Nu'uanu Avenue became known as Fid Street, reflecting the sailor's name for booze. Pubs popped up everywhere along the street, and investor Walter C. Peacock opened a series of bars, starting with this building in 1890. When it was called the Royal Tavern, Mark Twain and King Kalakaua, as well as wealthy shipowners and their sailors, stopped in. Peacock was known to sell wholesale booze, mostly gin, from that location. Today, these bottles are sought after as collector's items. The building has been home to bars, except for a few years when it was a furniture store during Prohibition. It's among buildings like Bishop Bank, the Melchers Building, and the Yokohama Specie Bank in the Merchant Street Historic District. Those buildings are more than a century old. Today, the Royal Saloon Building still stands at number 2 Merchant Street. And nobody got that quiz today, but that's our quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. Its 2018 Hawaii Literacy Innovation Conference features Ray McNulty, January 29th through February 1st. Achieve3000.com/community/events.
E.J. Dionne is a political journalist and Washington Post columnist with an unusual perspective. Could the Trump administration, as he suggests, lead to a renewal of liberal democratic values and policies? The author of One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported, is speaking on that subject in Honolulu this evening. We spoke earlier this morning, and he addressed what he describes as the roots of Trumpism.
There has always been a far right in the Republican Party, and you can go back to McCarthyism. You can go back to the rise of the Birch Society in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. I am struck by how many of the tropes that you see in places like Breitbart are really tropes that go back to the Birch Society, sort of certain conspiracy theories, certain attitudes toward globalism. Remember, the old term globaloney was invented way back in the 40s and 50s to mm-hmm. attack Truman and Acheson and all those folks. So that's one piece that goes back. A second piece that goes back a long way is obviously racial reaction. Mm-hmm. And back in the day, it was the right wing of the Democratic Party that represented segregation.
Dixiecrats.
The Dixiecrats. And starting with the Goldwater campaign in 1960, all of that opinion, those white Southerners moved into the Republican Party. Nixon had the Southern Strategy, which mm-hmm. was a subtle version of appeals around racial backlash. And mm-hmm. Trump has been much more explicit in many cases in very frightening and offensive ways, going back to the first day of his candidacy when he talked about Mexican immigrants as rapists. And it's gone on from there. So that's the second piece that's been there. But the third piece, I think, rests in the reaction in first in the Gingrich years and then in the Obama years. I think you began in when Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House with a strategy that didn't just disagree with Democrats, didn't just criticize Democrats, but really tried to say the Democratic Party is so profoundly corrupt that they have no right to govern. It was almost denying the legitimacy of the opposition. Mm-hmm. And then when Trump was a birther back in the Obama years, Republicans were very, the leadership of the party was very reluctant to criticize him. In our book, we note the moment when John Boehner was pressed on Meet the Press by David Gregory. And Boehner said, well, of course, I don't think Obama was born in Kenya, but he wouldn't condemn the birthers. He wouldn't condemn Trump. He said people have a right to believe what they want to believe. Well, you have a right to have deep beliefs. You don't have a right to believe things that are flatly untrue. And I think that opened the way for it. Even ironically, Mitt Romney, who emerged as a great and in some ways courageous critic of Trump, if you go back to the day Trump endorsed Romney for president, mm-hmm. He was gushing about Donald Trump. He really wanted that constituency. So Trump did not come from nowhere. There are within Republicanism and conservatism a lot of roots to Trumpism. He was just less subtle about it than some of his opponents.
E.J., you mentioned Goldwater and then later Nixon's Southern strategy. And in the days of conservatism starting to really make its push to take over the Republican Party, there were a lot of code terms used. I'm thinking of law and order, for example. But there was a lot of signaling to about race and about, you know, the perception that you know, white privilege that sort of got out in the open with Trump. The language got out in the open.
Right. Well, there's a popular saying now that Republicans and conservatives used to use the politics of the dog whistle, i.e. words that one right. side would hear and the other wouldn't necessarily hear. Right. And they've gone from the dog whistle to the bullhorn. Mm-hmm. And I think it is one of the, you know, there are many aspects of Trump and Trumpism that are disturbing. But I think one of the most disturbing is how we have normalized a kind of racial discourse that we had decided for a very long time was unacceptable. And even people who were playing subtle racial politics right. felt a moral or political obligation to play it in a subtle way. And now you have some overtly racist views and ideas out in the open in a very troubling way. I think that's why the Charlottesville demonstrations were so disturbing. And Trump's so-called even-handedness about that, where you had a demonstration where Nazis were involved on one side. I don't think there are two sides to Nazism.
Well, obviously somebody does, and the overt language of the last few years has taken hold in ways that have really surprised a lot of people.
Right. And, because we congratulated ourselves, and legitimately so, to some degree, in the fact that we Americans elected Barack Obama as president of the United States. And in truth, if you look around the world, there are not very many countries you can point to that elected a member of a racial minority to be their president, to be their leader. And particularly given the history of slavery and racism in the United States, it was all the more remarkable. So it's legit for us to say, that's pretty cool that we did that as a nation. That didn't mean, however, that racism disappeared. And while I am not of the view that all of the opposition to Obama was racially motivated, ideology is a separate category. There are conservatives who are not at all racist who didn't like Barack Obama's policies. And I think it's important that liberals say that. On the other hand, as in the birther movement, as in some of the other things you saw out of that, as you often heard at the time in Rush Limbaugh broadcasts, there were explicitly racist themes that were being mobilized against Obama. So I don't think the Obama years sort of created Trumpism, as we said earlier. I think the roots go back deeper. But there was a tip-off that in some of the reaction to Obama that this persists. And again, in fairness to Americans, we're not the only country that is struggling with racism. And I think that's sort of one of the real challenges of this moment, is to the very idea of liberal democracy, that is with a small L and a small D, around the West, where you have a pushback against pluralism, against the idea that people of different races, backgrounds can live together in a democracy. You know, you're seeing a backlash in France, in Germany, in Britain, all over the West, in Hungary. And this is very disturbing. And we Americans are supposed to be the model for how you create a pluralist democracy. And at the moment, I think we are falling down on what is one of our central obligations to the whole world.
Is Trumpism likely to galvanize liberal democracy?
I think that our book is, in an odd way, optimistic in the sense that it's really quite remarkable the pushback you've seen in the country against Trumpism. That Trump's disapproval rating has been around 58 or 60%. Most of us are not Trumpists. Most people oppose Trump. If you look at all of these legislative races over the years, you recently had another one in Wisconsin where the Democrats took seats from the Republicans. 34 legislative seats have flipped Democratic. Only four have flipped toward the Republicans in that period. And you saw it in the elections this last year in Virginia, in New Jersey, and really wherever there was voting, there was a backlash against the Republicans that was really an anti-Trump backlash. The other side of this is, on a lot of these issues, civil society, you know, the organizations of Americans that are not directly political, mobilized against the travel ban and have mobilized against some of the efforts that pushing back against women's rights. I mean, you're really seeing a broad pushback in the country. The test will be in this November's elections. And at the moment, you are, and it's a long, only after 2016, I think all pundits should turn in their prediction licenses for about 4 years. So I'm not going to predict what's going to happen in November. But if the election were held right now, on the basis of the numbers you're looking at right now, it would be a rout against the Republicans. And a lot of that, most of that, is a reaction to Trump.
E.J. Dionne is the co-author of One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. He will be speaking at 6:30 this evening at the Artistry Honolulu on Cook Street in Kaka'ako on the subject, Will the Trump Administration Renew American Democracy? The event is free, open to the public, and moderated by our news director, Bill Dorman. You can learn more on the Conversation's Facebook page.
There are lots of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at some of the events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. And today he's here to tell us about a local actor who's written his first play, and you can see it at Kumukuhua Theater.
Yes, William Kahele wrote Living Room. That's a semi-autobiographical piece, a comedy about a man who deals with his troubled past and uncertain future. Now, this play contains some adult themes and language. Living Room continues tomorrow at 8 at Kumukuhua, and it runs through February 18th.
It's a great little theater downtown.
Nice little secret.
Intimate.
Intimate, yeah. Right.
And tomorrow there's a film night and discussion on Hawaii Island?
Yes. The film is Let the Mountain Speak, produced by Vilsoni Hiriniko and Jeanette Paulson Hiriniko. It's described as a 5-minute visual poem on Mauna Kea, produced in both Hawaiian and English, and presented to the Big Island community. Let the Mountain Speak is from 6 to 8 p.m. at Donkey Mill Arts Center in Hualualoa.
Yeah, and Vili and Jeanette do great work.
Oh, yeah.
So that's one to watch. And we can learn how to prepare Ono plant-based recipes in a class in Kailua tomorrow.
Tomorrow in Kailua, there is a cooking demonstration in partnership with Adventist Health Castle, and that begins at 6 p.m. It costs $12 for this class, and you'll receive recipe cards of the dishes that you made so you can try them at home. Space is limited, so be sure to RSVP at this phone number, 263-5050, and you can also find that phone number on the HPR website.
All right. Thanks a lot, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at the events in our community under the radar. You can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
We continue this season's series of Hawaii's Piano Jazz Masters in HPR's Atherton Studio. You're listening now to Joshua Kay, who'll be performing on February 3rd. He calls this piece, Smile Upon Me. Yeah, he'll make you smile. Call the station during business hours to reserve your seats to Jazz Master Joshua Kay or go to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, it's National School Choice Week, and we're holding a panel discussion on ideas in education, inviting you to weigh in.
That's right. Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. Here's a number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or Twitter at HI Conversation. This show and all our past ones are available on The Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation. Mm-hmm.